Welcome people in the room, welcome people online. We're on the last class of the last unit of Discovering Buddhism. So it's like the last class of the 3-year cycle. So welcome to the tying it all up in a bow. A lot of this class is very easy and very practical for those of you been coming along. But if you haven't been coming along for the 3 years, it may just sound all totally esoteric. So just please enjoy the environment. And if it gets a bit boring, you could go, I won't take it personally. It's so nice to see you again anyway. So what we've covered already in the course, the six names of Tantra, what makes Tantra unique? How the foundation of the three principal aspects of the path is what makes Tantra Buddhist. Qualities of a student and a Vajra master. The different classes of Tantra. What the substantial causes for Dharmakaya, the mind of a Buddha, and Rupakaya, the body of a Buddha, are, and how we can recognize them in each of the practices. And then we looked at Path of Action Tantra. And path of high sugar tantra. So the last 2 weeks, action tantra and high sugar tantra had, similarities. Was there anything, so those of you that were here, that stood out for you about those 2 weeks? Or alternately, were there any questions about those 2 weeks, either of those paths, the lower tantras or high sugar tantra? There's general information in Introduction to Tantra, Lama Yeshe, and like Secret of the Vajra World and various other things that's quite general. But usually to actually learn about it, you need the initiation. Yeah. And so then because it's particular to each practice as well. So you can just kind of learn generically, but even then, I mean, in the olden days, that was supposed to be secret. Now it's kind of just a general kind of explanation. There's kind of no point in just learning about them for interest's sake. It's like you learn about them to practice. And so for that, it's got to be associated with an initiation and with the instructions of how to practice. And then it comes alive. And so you don't have to worry about missing out on that because with any initiation, there's always the sadhana and the instructions given. And like I said before, the couple of days teaching after the ceremony is actually the initiation. The initiation with all the rituals and everything just kind of primes our mind. But the actual transmission of the practice comes in those few days afterwards of the teachings. What we're going to have a look at then tonight, the key to success, ensuring success in our practice. And that is all to do with guru devotion. And, every single text says without guru devotion, realizations are impossible. Now, it's a little hard to get your head around this because you often think, well, how come I can't? I have all this amazing stuff that you can read from a book. Why is guru devotion necessary? But as we'll see, it is really important. Without it, it's not going to touch our heart. The other thing is we've got to have an idea what actually realizations are. Because talk about, oh, I had a realization, but realizations are really specific things. It's not like it's a burden though, because guru devotion is actually what makes us feel confident. It's just like if we have a really good teacher, it makes us feel confident. Our teacher sees qualities in us that we don't recognize, and we might feel terrible, but if they go, you can do it, we believe them, and then we strive for it, and that's what makes all the difference. And we also know if a teacher calls us an idiot or says, you'll never get it, how deflating that is and how it can echo in your life for decades afterwards. So the teacher is really important. The other thing that we're going to look at is the retreat, doing a retreat. And as Rinpoche says, A retreat is like the ultimate holiday. And what's it a holiday from? From the neurosis. It's a holiday from our problems. Because we all yearn for a holiday. I mean, I assume we all yearn for a holiday. But the real holiday can only be found within. And as the saying goes, wherever you go, there you are. So we take all of our problems along with us. So how do we actually deal with those? It's with the retreat. A retreat from samsara and the neuroses. And the purpose of a retreat is that if we don't support our study with equal amounts of application of actual practice, we'll start burning out. We'll start thinking, oh, I just need to study more. I'm not studying enough. And we'll start feeling a bit pressured or a bit stressed about our Dharma practice. Or worse, we'll start becoming a bit impatient with other people, like, oh, what a stupid question. Or didn't they know that? Or I want to listen to something more advanced. And we may even become a little jaded or cynical. So all of that happens, all of those kind of feelings, especially you can tell if you start becoming impatient with people, it comes because we haven't been putting what we've studied into practice. That's the tell, that's the red flag. So how to actually put it into practice in a retreat. So let's set our motivation. And as we're at the last class and we've been talking about the Dharmakaya and the Sambhogakaya and the Nimanakaya, when we think of our guru, of our refuge, bring to mind Guru Vajradhara, the Tantric Buddha. And we can recite the refuge and bodhicitta prayer. Sangye charan sagye chanam lai chan chue padue tanyi kyab sui chi Dagye chanye kyabbe sonayam gye Trolai panche sangye tropa shui Sangye charan sagye chanam lai chan chue padue tanyi kyab sui chi Dagi chenye kepe sonam gye Drola panche sangye dropa shoe. And in English, I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. Seven Limb Prayer. Kusong go pe kan e cha se loy Noi sham yi choy cha tri ma ubu Toi men e sai ti ton tam che shai Ke pai ke wai nam lai che iran and offering a mandala. Meeting the maestro. So the meeting the guru is like meeting the maestro. So in a way, if you think about it, what if you met someone that was a natural genius, that loved you unconditionally, that was the ultimate networker and could introduce you to all the important people in the world, who understood your personality, like the very best life coach, and who had secret powers like Superman. So you put all of that together, that's really when we're talking about the guru or the maestro meeting the guru, that's what it's like. So here we are in our precious human rebirth, so rare to find, which is like the biggest lotto in history. To actually get this human rebirth of one in a peaceful country and with education and pretty much everything at our fingertips. So then to meet the guru is even like even more impossible, even more amazing to be able to meet the guru. So Rinpoche says about our precious human rebirth, it's like it seems impossible, yet it happened. Meeting the guru is almost like a miracle on top of that. So they say that the guru devotion is the root of the path, and how this is because we unify ourselves, our mind, our approach with the source of inspiration of the guru. And how we do that is through a practice called guru yoga practice, so meditation. And it's meditation that has a profound effect on our psychology. So this is from Lama Yeshe, from Introduction to Tantra. And it gives you an idea of this practice. So either in front of us or above the crown of our head, we visualize the main meditational deity of the tantra that we're practicing, surrounded by the various gurus of the lineage. Or for those of us who've been doing refuge, we imagine Shakyamuni Buddha and all the gurus of the lineage. And these lineage gurus are the successive masters who have passed on the teachings and realizations of that particular practice and include everyone from the first master of the lineage through to our own spiritual guide, the guru from whom we receive the initiation. We then request the members of this assembly to bestow their inspiration and blessings upon us, and in response to this request, they merge with one another, dissolving into light, and enter us through the crown of our head in the form of light, and descend our central channel and dissolve into our heart center. As this happens, all ordinary dualistic appearances and conceptions dissolve, and the clear space of emptiness, dissolve into the clear space of emptiness. And we then meditate upon the feeling that our guru, who in essence is identical with the deity, and our own subtle consciousness have become indistinguishably one. So the whole purpose of this, doing this practice again and again in imagination is because our nervous system can't tell the difference between what's real, what's imagined. So we get the benefit just by imagining. We get the benefit not just emotionally, but all the way through physiologically as well. How come we have to do this practice? Because we're really unaware of our true nature. If we were, we would be waking up every single morning going, wow, I could become a Buddha today. So does anyone wake up saying that?
No.
Not yet. So that shows we are disconnected from our potential, from our nature. How do we reconnect? By going through this process of the guru devotion. So if we don't practice guru devotion, what happens is that we might have a few moments of inspiration, be inspired by one of the lamas, or, moved to tears by His Holiness the Dalai Lama. But we kind of just leave it at that. We just think, oh, that's it. That's the experience. That's just like the beginning of the experience. We have to start practicing. Because otherwise, that initial feeling or experience will wear off. And so then our practice deteriorates. And it's really easy then to just fall under the spells of samsara and distractions. And so then we think, oh, I just got to go to teachings again and talk to the lamas, get another hit. But that's not like it either. Then we're relying on an external guru, we're not integrating it. So that said, there are different types of gurus, and you might have heard so the root guru or the heart guru or the day-to-day mentor. So generally, when you talk about a root guru, this is the first lama who you have your first highest yoga tantra initiation from becomes your root guru. That's the technical kind of definition. And this is kind of like, say if you're going to get the deeds to a house, the person that actually hands you the deeds to the house, whether you know them or not, you've got them in your hand. There might have been many other people that have helped you along the way and guided you and showed you how to do this or that. But the actual person that puts the deeds of the house into your hands, they're the one. The deeds of the instructions how to become a Buddha. But many of us maybe have a real heart connection with a lama, and so that in a way we can think of as like our heart guru, the one that we really connect with. And when Geshe Zopa was here, he was saying you can think of your root guru as the one that you're the most connected to at the moment, who's guiding you closely at the moment. So your root guru can change. And then, of course, there are the day-to-day mentors. There are gurus like Geshe Saltram that doesn't give initiations, but and is very approachable and friendly, and that we can ask questions of. And actually, you guys could come to his, he comes once a month, and it's called Ask the Geshe, and you can ask him anything about life, the universe, and everything. And he gives really good answers. So that's more like our day-to-day mentor. So why I've put meeting the maestro, the guru is like the maestro, like the absolute master, the professor. And say at uni, you've got tutors, and then you've got classmates, and you don't hang out with a professor. It's like they're like way out of our league. It's too much, let alone the master class, the maestro. You spend a few moments with the maestro and they blow your mind, and you've got enough to work on for a whole year. So we kind of have this idea when, oh, we've got to find a guru and then spend all our time with them. But it's not like that. It's like you spend a really quality, concerted time with them, and then you have other types of gurus along the way that help you integrate it and do the day-to-day work. So does that make sense? It's all okay. The lama who gives the refuge vows becomes your refuge master. So they are a guru, and they're your preceptor. So you have a special connection with them as a refuge master. So yeah, you want to have a good connection with them. The maestro is like the one, because they have they give you the instructions, the whole package to bring forth the rainbow body of a Buddha and transform into a Buddha, in that highest yoga tantra initiation. That's why they're the root guru, because that's the key, the heart instructions. So I've got three real main reasons why we need a guru and why we can't just do it on our own. So one of them is the guru's like a living example. So who started off just like us, but actually has put in all the work and developed beyond what we presently think is possible as a human being or as a meditation master or anything. So I put a picture of the chocolate cake here because this is the difference between reading all the books on chocolate cakes and becoming an expert on chocolate cakes and actually getting the chocolate cake and tasting the chocolate cake and going, wow, There's a really big difference. It's great to be an expert on chocolate cakes, but we need an example. We need to see it done in front of our eyes. We need to see a wise, compassionate person is possible. And we need to see, the ways that the gurus act that blow our minds, really, how they can answer simultaneously everybody's question in the room in one teaching without anybody even having to ask those questions. And once you have an experience like that, or you experience the kindness and the wisdom of the guru, then that's it. Then it really, then you have the confidence. So that's really different from books. Then the other thing about a guru is that a guru is in a lineage, an unbroken lineage from the time of the Buddha, from the lineage of that particular deity. And so this lineage, you think of it as like a spiritual heritage. So if we had, it's like discovering if we have royalty in the family. So if you go and you find out about your family tree and you find out you have a famous ancestor, like I was related to, I don't know, well, in my school when I was little, we had someone who was related to Ned Kelly.
Yeah.
And we were like super impressed.
If you're related to a convict.
That's right, if you're related to a convict, but if maybe, if you're related to Madame Curie or Curie or someone, you'd be super proud about it. So this is like you're actually now becoming related to the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. So in one word, actually, this is, if we're going to sum it up, this lineage, it's not like a lineage of bosses that intimidate us. It's a lineage of friends. It's like we have friends, like the best family. They're not dysfunctional. They have all of our best interests at heart, and they can help us. And they're our friends. And we can actually draw on their wisdom and their life stories and everything. And the third one, a guru has much more than just academic knowledge. They carry the insights and living experience. So many times there's what's in the books, but then there's also what's called the ear-whispered lineage. So that's the instructions, the oral instructions that you get on the day, or the instructions that you get on pilgrimage on the fly or in the shopping centre if you're doing shopping for the guru or something like that, that are really special. There are also living insights in that, and why I put a picture here of a racing car driver. And not only can you not learn to drive a car from a book, you really have to learn to drive a car from someone who can drive a car. But if you're going to drive a race car, you need an expert car driver. And that's a living experience that is passed down. So when we're doing these meditation practices, it's a living experience. Yes.
I've got a question from Maisie Jane.
Yep.
She says, so 30 years ago, I had an initiation into another type of practice. It was Surat Shabad Yoga or Sound Current Yoga. Would he remain my root guru? This was not Buddhist, more akin to Sufi. How does this relate to taking a guru in this path?
So you would, Maisie Jane, you'd really think this is definitely one of your gurus, one of your first gurus, perhaps your heart guru, but not your root guru, because it doesn't give you the keys and instructions to becoming a Buddha in this lifetime. But also, it's not like you can only have one guru. You can have many gurus with many different roles. So along the way, we have different gurus that help us in each little step. And they may even be non-religious. They may even be that one teacher at school that really believed in you. Or they may be an incredible auntie that helped you. So they may be from a book as well. I think Nietzsche's one of my gurus, got me through so many decades. So then you just have them in your merit field, And you get the hierarchy right. So you have Guru Vajradhara in the middle and the highest yoga tantra deities and lowest. And then you have all of your like worldly, sorry, all of your other lineage gurus, and then all your worldly gurus, like who taught you to read and write, who taught you to look after yourself. So you have a hierarchy that represents their importance and include them in, yeah. So one time when Chördön Rinpoche was here and he was giving a teaching on the Taras, on the 21 Taras. You were there, Ben? Yeah. And it was like he was just reporting what he was seeing from the Pure Lands. It wasn't like he was reading through a text or anything like that. He was just going, oh, yeah, and then there's this, and oh, yeah, and then this is happening, this is happening. And so one of the things that he said was that when Tara has the seed syllable, the tum, at her heart, and so we're used to how it's drawn, looks a little bit like a very complicated five. And so he said the seed syllable is not like this, it's like this. Because how you draw a letter, it's got a head and a tail. And so we're actually seeing them from the side, like an elephant with a head and a tail. So we write them like that so we can see what they are. But actually, if the head's pointing forward and the tail's at the back, it's like this. So if you're looking from the front, it's just a line. And all of the studious people in the front, including nuns and monks, went, oh, that's not right. We'll have to, and they're going, we'll have to go check that with the text. And I'm like, oh my God, you just missed it here. This is incredible experiential information of someone that actually has an experience of this seed syllable, this really subtle body, this subtle letter, and is just sharing it with us spontaneously. Yeah, so not only you had that physical kind of dizziness of being in his presence, but Ruth Gamble, who was a student here ages ago, and she became a translator. And so she was translating for Chödön Rinpoche, and he's incredibly quietly spoken, so quiet. So the first thing that happened was that we had a microphone, and it just like it just blew up.
Oh.
It's just like it short circuited. And so then we got a different microphone. They actually brought out his microphone that he travels with and hooked that up. So he got that one. And Ruth was saying, even though he was talking so quietly, she just felt like this roaring freight train was just going through her head at 100 miles an hour the entire time. That the intensity of it and the loudness of it and how difficult it was, and she was just shattered at the end from translating. Yeah, it was really quite something. So yeah, the appearances were quite different from the. They're at our heart, and they're not going to the left. They're not crossing our body like this. We're all facing the same way. Yeah, that's right. So that's the difference between like a sadhana, which is like a manual, it's a diagram, and a lived practice. And that's the difference between what you'd read in the best racing car driving manuals and then what the actual driver tells you. It's really different. Yeah. Yeah, that's right. The chakras as well, they're drawn like this. But how they are is different. But also how they are at the moment is all knotted. But we're not going to draw knots. Because we're not going to meditate on knots. We're going to meditate on beautiful, symmetrical, open. Yeah. And even when you think about it, when we draw atoms and the nucleus and all of that, they don't look like that. For a long time, I thought they did. Okay. So here's from Reginald Ray, Secret of the Vajra World. The state of mind of all the Buddhas is Dharmakaya itself. The nature of our mind is also Dharmakaya. The fact that we have the same essence, serves as a direct link between us and all awakened beings. But lacking faith and devotion, it's as though the Dharmakaya nature of our mind is encased in obscurations. However, the very moment you open up in devotion, you receive the blessings of the Buddhas. The Dharmakaya of enlightened beings is like a butter lamp where the flame is burning brightly, and the Dharmakaya nature of a sentient being's mind is like a butter lamp where the wick has not yet been lit. Therefore, it's very important to allow compassion and blessings of enlightened beings to enter us. The link between us and the state of enlightenment is faith and devotion. So that means that real instinctually being able to relax. And of course, as we remember from the previous classes, it's not just any old guru. We've already checked out our guru really is a maestro, not a sham. Okay, so that's that caveat. So then the next question, well, who is the guru really? And in my mind, I mean, we're trying to kind of bridge over to our modern culture. A guru is actually like the ultimate coach. It's probably the closest that we can think of. So a coach to help us conquer our delusions. So our whole life, we're like in a boxing ring, you know, and we're punch drunk, and we're punch drunk with just trying to deal with our delusions, our afflicted states of mind, the afflicted states of mind of other people, how we can just make it worse so easily, all of this, and we're just running, hoping for the best and often making things even worse. And really, we are. Samsara is just a state of being totally punch drunk. And here is a coach that knows exactly how to train us and how to help us, and how to say, do this now and hold back here. And you need to have a good relationship. You need to have a coach that you can really rely on, because your guru devotion has to be stronger than your instincts. Because our instincts are samsaric mostly. You know, we run away from what we don't like and we just crave all the things and we don't like being uncomfortable and all of this stuff. So, or we get scared. So our guru devotion has to cut through all of that. And that's really, if you know anything about the great boxers, this is the incredible relationship between a boxer and their coach, is that they just unequivocally trust their coach. And even when in the middle of the fight they're like, no, I can do it, I can do it, and the coach says stop, they'll stop. And even when they're like, no, it's all over, I can't do it, the coach will just say that one word and they'll, right, I can do it, they'll get their mojo back and they'll win. So Mike Tyson had a coach early on called Cus D'Amato that was like, Cus was like a, you know, his father, his mother, his brother, he was his everything, and his coach, and taught him to read, taught him how to wash, all of these things he didn't know. So that's a real guru-disciple relationship right there. And, of course, when Cus died, then it was terrible for Tyson, like his whole life derailed for several decades until the Hangover movie came along, really.
Still, I need to know how you know whether the guru you choose to take HYT initiation from is the right one for the next so many incarnations, let alone this one.
Yeah.
And how do we have devotion to someone who we've never met, maybe until the initiation day?
That's right. So of course, we've got our checklist. Do they meet the qualifications of a Vajra master? That's our checklist. So that should be number one. Number two, number one is have we ourselves met the qualifications as a student? And then does the guru meet those qualifications? And you can check that out. And any SPC in a center should be able to furnish you with that information. But then you also have to have a connection with that guru, maybe you've read a book or maybe you've seen them on YouTube, you have a connection. You're not like, oh no, I don't get this person. So if that's it, that may not work. And not only that, but you need to have a connection with the initiation that you're taking. So you have to do a little bit of not just external research, but also make aspirational prayers for a dream, for something from your, deeper, less convoluted self to come up. But we'll also get into this a little bit more in a moment, how to then relate to a guru, how to create that relationship. And it is a, there is a spectrum. So first off, if we're, I mean, we start off being out of touch with our inner guru, but if we remain out of touch with our inner guru, we can't actually integrate the Dharma. So all of the guru yoga practices, those meditations, are about how to listen to the inner guru. And what's the inner guru? It's your wisdom. That's the inner guru. So how much can we listen to our inner wisdom? So I remember quite a few years ago, a friend of mine who was quite young, and she got pregnant, and she didn't know, should I have a baby or should I have an abortion? And she's ringing me up. I was like her auntie. And so I asked her, well, what did your guru say? And she said, oh, he just said, oh, dear, you'll know what to do. And but if that was it. It was like this incredible vote of confidence. And I'm like, and what is that? And she knew immediately, just like that. So he connected her with her wisdom. And because she was so devoted to him, she just needed someone to say, oh, instead of like, oh no, what are you going to do? Just like, you'll know what to do. And she did. So, how to listen to the inner guru? And I suppose at the beginning, our inner guru is a little bit like our conscience, isn't it? We know when we've done something that we know wasn't quite right, or it later doesn't sit well with us. And we might try and justify it all over the place, but we know. And that's, I mean, it's an uncomfortable feeling, but it shows that that conscience, that's like our inner wisdom. Now, the person of the guru is not the guru. So when, with that prayer, calling the guru from afar, what do we think of when we recite that prayer? What do you think of? Who do you think of? Kensa Rinpoche? Lama
Zopa
Rinpoche? Geshe Loden? Yeah. And is that it?
No,
The Iram? Yep. So that's the thing, that the person of the guru is like the tip of the iceberg. But that's just the tiniest smidgen of who the guru is. So who the guru is the Dharmakaya wisdom. That's the real guru. And then how do we connect with that? Through all the different manifestations of the guru, including the Idam, the Buddhas, the Bodhisattvas, the deities. So we have like a relative guru. That's the teacher, our most precious teacher, who guides us, who we really trust, who inspires us, who believes in us even when we don't believe in us. That's the relative guru. Inner guru is our own wisdom. The ultimate guru is the clear light mind, is that Dharmakaya that's not separate from the Buddha. So there is a process of maturation that we go through with guru devotion. It's not a static thing. It changes over time. So this is from, again, Secret of the Vajra World, and I found it really useful just to know that this is possible. So the second point, the relationship matures until we internalize the guru. So first off, we have some kind of attraction or connection to the teacher. In the beginning, one may feel instinctively drawn toward a certain teacher. One may be impressed by the intelligence, kindness, or dignity of that person and want to draw closer to them and find out more about them. So then trust in the teachings. Then the student might receive instructions from the teacher and discover that what's being taught helps a great deal. At this level, one trusts the teachings as being true and beneficial. So, you know, we try it out. We try out Geshe Sultram's Ask the Geshe, you know, instructions to go, oh, hey, this works. I'm getting on better with my family. There might be something to it. So then three, faith in the teacher. From this, the student may then begin to develop some faith in the person of the teacher. That is the person who knows important things and is able to communicate them in a way that can be understood. At this juncture, equally important as the formal teachings being received are the student's personal experiences with the teacher and observations of how he or she conducts themselves. One can see how helpful the teacher has been to oneself. And beyond this, one observes the teacher in all kinds of situations, interacting with their other disciples. They may even be seen in difficult straits, pressed to the wall, so to speak. Then one can assess whether they are really kind, whether they're genuinely patient, insightful, and selfless with others. He or she may be observed continually sacrificing their comfort and security in order to help those who come to them. As one sees more and finds oneself with more and more faith in the trustworthiness of the teacher, one begins to discover greater and greater openness in him or her and finds oneself expectant and receptive to what the teacher presents. And at this point, it's critical that the disciple begin to put the teachings into practice. So that's a really good point. Seeing the teacher under stress, you know, that's like the exam for the teacher to see how do they act. And, you know, I just see, like, for instance, like Geshe Zopa, he's so courageous. Just in any, and also Khyentse Rinpoche, in any situation, in any country, doesn't matter what language they're speaking, he's just right up there introducing himself, incredibly friendly, helping others, showing the way, discovering this is the shortcut and this and whatever. And, you know, just the more tired he is, the more he does that. Now, one time years ago, Khyentse Rinpoche took me and a couple of volunteers and Eddie out to dinner at a Tibetan restaurant. And so he just arranged everything. He's like, you sit here, you sit here, you sit here. And then he was up and he was into the kitchen and before and he was there with the chefs and he was like stirring the soup and he's like, comes out with both of them, one with either arm, and introduces them to everybody. He's like completely in the thick of it. And of course, everyone's beaming. Yes, so then, okay, so we have a great time. We really have this connection. So that the crucial thing here is we've got to start putting the teachings into practice. Otherwise, it just becomes like spiritual materialism. We just want to hang out with the teacher. And so there's many, many older students of Lama Yeshe and Lama Zopa Rinpoche that when they passed away, they kind of lost it because now who are they going to hang out with? And so they're happy when they go to teachings, and when they're not at teachings, they're not happy. There's something fundamentally skewed about that. Okay, so then the next kind of step along this maturation, the longing for the teacher. So seeing all the good qualities in turn leads to the desire to see more of the teacher, receive more of their teachings. And at this point, the teacher will say, if you really want to be close to me, then look to your practice. It's through your meditation alone that you'll be able to fulfill this longing. So that's like instead of the longing, the external one to hang out with the teacher, we've got to look within. It is true that the more one practices and the nearer one draws to one's own Buddha nature, the closer one feels to one's teacher. One increasingly understands his teaching on deeper levels and begins to share his world, and sometimes even experiences moments of inseparability with them in the meditation. So that feeling of the closeness, it comes from the practice. And then the fifth stage, complete surrender. The final stage of devotion is a willingness to relinquish one's logical reference points and to trust the teacher wholeheartedly. This is a very advanced stage of devotion and not for beginners. At the beginner's level, this kind of surrender would be a regression to the dependency of a small child on its parent. If a person attempted or was permitted to move into this kind of devotion too early, his or her opportunity for spiritual growth would be cut off. The Vajrayana operates by eliciting and provoking the projections of our own deepest nature and then forcing us back on ourselves, so we have to integrate and take possession of these projections. This process is seen no more clearly than in the relation of teacher and student that forms the backbone of the path. Trungpa Rinpoche comments that at the beginning of the path, the teacher is seen virtually as a demigod. In the middle, he is experienced as a friend and companion. And at the end, when we've attained the state of realization that we once saw uniquely in him, he becomes inseparable from the inborn living wisdom within. So the complete surrender, and I remember my mother into saying, you know, if what doesn't matter what Lama Zopa Rinpoche would ask me, I would do anything that he said. So that kind of devotion, that's the advanced type of devotion. It can't be at the beginning. So questions, comments, how are we going? Ian, yeah.
You're really here talking about a spiritual relationship, not like a whole of life coach who helps you with every part of your life.
No, it's a spiritual relationship, but it is it's the same dynamic as a coach. It's like we're in the boxing ring of samsara. So, yeah, you wouldn't rely on your guru for necessarily cooking instructions, for how maybe the rules of the land, what's legal, building code regulations, for instance. So if your guru comes from Nepal, he's like, just build it, just stick it up there. And then it's like, no, Australian have building codes. No, just do it. So you've got to be able to say, you are my guru leading me to enlightenment, and I am your guru with building codes. Yeah, really important to get that right.
And that would be the area that they're qualified in.
Yes,
too.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
People are qualified in certain things.
And they only need to be qualified in those certain things. They don't need to be qualified in the other ones. So that's also where we can kind of get it mixed up, because so this will also help Maisie Jane's question, correctly relying on the guru. And I love this photograph of His Holiness with the thousand arm Chenrezig behind. So, of course, fulfill your responsibilities as student first and then check the qualifications of the guru. And so the guru just has to be able to, you know, in sutra, to accurately show us the path, to have a clear grasp of the scriptures, to walk the talk, live ethically, all of those things. In Tantra, they need many more qualifications. But we've got to fulfill our responsibilities first, because we can have the very best possible school, but if we don't actually go to class, if we don't show up from our side, it's not going to help. So we've got to show up first. I mean, we've had quite a few different Geshe's come and teach here that have been resident up at Chenrezig Institute. And so there was one Geshe that I had a very difficult relationship with Geshe Jamyang. And so, you know, on a personal level, it was really fraught. And being the program coordinator here and having to invite him, even that was really difficult. And so he would come and he'd give teachings. Maybe the first 40 minutes of the teachings, he'd just kind of give kind of notes on life and pretty much tell everyone how hopeless they were, how lazy Westerners were, how they didn't care about Tibet, how no one put any effort into study or teachings or anything, and everyone would just get really demoralised or really angry and never come back. And then after about 40 minutes of this, he'd dive into the text, and he was absolutely brilliant at elucidating the text. Really good. And the most accomplished analogies, really modern ones that really hit home that you got it. And not only that, but the parallel teaching that happens sometimes in teachings where you're at a teaching and your mind, it's not distracted, but it's thinking about other things and you get all answers to the other things. So many of the Lungri Tumpa Center inventions came from his teachings, including the Afflictions to Perfections game came to my mind during Geshe Jamyang's teachings. So, and all these other things. So I feel incredibly blessed by his teachings. And yet the relationship was really fraught on an ordinary level. So that didn't matter to me because my priority was the Dharma. So I, you know, just sucked it up with the rest and it didn't worry me. I was terrified, but then I wasn't terrified. So, you know, as long as you have the Dharma as the priority. We also have to put effort into this relationship. It's not something that we wait for it to hit us. That's like waiting for Godot. And you know what that means. Yeah. So, yay, finally. You're an educated person, Pam. So we have to put effort into what we're looking for because we're not looking for a slick presentation. We're not looking for just charisma. I mean, there's millions of charlatans out there that have a slick presentation and beautiful produced books and lovely backdrops and all sorts of things, but we want that the real teaching. And so that might come out without the slick advertising. So many people would show up to Lama Zopa Rinpoche's courses expecting Rinpoche to go through the Lam Rim point by point, just like the Geshe's do, and they'd be there at the end of the course and they're like, we haven't even got past the introduction and it's been 6 weeks. When are we going to get to the text? It's like we've got to the text already over and over and over again. We just didn't do it that way. So, I mean, again, at one of the teachings, the Lama Zopa Rinpoche teachings, that when he came to Lungri Tumpa Center, we were still in Newmarket, so we had to hire the Italian club, which was just down the road from us. So it was really quite bizarre because there was a mirror ball in the room and in amongst the teachings from Rinpoche where there was these strains of accordion music coming in. And the sound was really terrible. So some people in the room could hear and others couldn't. And after a while, I was really happy about that because some of the things that Rinpoche was teaching about were really out there. Like he was talking about aliens and visitations from other planets and all sorts of stuff. I'm like, am I hearing this right? And I'm like, thank goodness all those people over there can't hear. But anyway, so I had my two friends on either side. I had Cheryl, who, you know, Cheryl and George, who donated the money for the half of this building on one side and Jordan on the other. And they were both getting incredibly agitated. And I'm like, what's going on? And so Jordan on this side was getting super agitated because she was so excited about the teaching. She's like, oh, my God, this is so amazing that she just had to go to the other side of the room because she couldn't contain herself. And we were just, like, wanting to go, whoa, all the time. There's too much. So she went over there. And then Cheryl here was going, oh, this guy is off his rocker. It's just stream of consciousness rubbish. Like, who knows? This is not the same guy that wrote all those books. No way. And she got up and left. And I'm just there by myself. But this is the thing, how what we expect, the kind of package that we expect, it's not going to be ordinary. And so if Cheryl was expecting the great man and didn't get it, didn't get that presentation, and he was hitting the microphone, and, of course, the whole problem, the reason that we had terrible sound problem was because one of the volunteers, I can do the sound, and he was like, yep, got it sorted. And, of course, just left it all the last minute and didn't have it sorted, totally overestimated his abilities, and the sound just carked it in the first 10 minutes. And so then he was like racing home to get another sound system, but it was so big it wouldn't fit in his car. It was just absolute disaster. So he had this whole other sideways teaching about just life and preparing for life. When something matters, how you react, how you plan has to be different from other things. You know, so there's multiple layers of teachings here. So we've got to put the effort in to create the relationship from our side, because also Khenpo Rinpoche, Geshe Tashi Tsering, he very purposefully the whole time has put forward an aspect of just being ordinary, of having, you know, no charisma, nothing special, like very, very ordinary. So he wouldn't show any of his extraordinariness. You had to really recognize it. And, you know, he was the resident teacher for like 18 years at Chenrezig Institute. It was only in the last 2 years that he became famous. The whole rest of the time, no one would go. Like, you know, the really devoted people would, but it wasn't a big deal. So we've got to make that effort to really focus on what are the good qualities here and recognize them. And how to correctly rely on the guru. So in action, physically, listen well and put the teachings into practice. So what do we do? That's what we do. Don't expect to be spoon-fed. We've got to do active listening. We've got to formulate our own questions. We have to actually kind of have those internal debates within ourselves so we come up with a question. And how to put those teachings in practice? Well, one of the best ways is to become a volunteer at a Dharma center and become the hands and feet of the guru, because that's what a volunteer is at a Dharma center. And then the best thing to offer is our practice. So Milarepa said, I don't have any material things to offer my teacher, but I still have the best offering, my practice and experiences. So that's the best thing to offer. In thought, cultivate confidence and respect. So we've got to remember they have our welfare at heart. They don't have ulterior motives. This is after having checked out the guru. So to be clear, like, for instance, Geshe Jamyang, he said, I don't want to be anybody's guru. He was very clear about that. But, not everybody, but some people wanted him to be their guru, and he said no. And they were devastated. They took it personally, but he didn't want the responsibility. So our appreciation will work once we start recognizing the qualities of the guru. And in Sutra, we see the Guru as being like the Buddha. In Tantra, we see the Guru as the Buddha, as a manifestation of the Buddha. And so this isn't anything to do with whether they are or not. It's going to help our mind. Because if we focus just on the good qualities, we're going to get that result. We're going to get the benefit. If we focus on their bad qualities, it's just not going to work, is it? So Lama Zorpa Rinpoche, for years and years, you know, he had that cough from TB. And so every third or fourth word he'd cough, and it would drive people insane. But Only certain people, because most people just didn't hear it. It's like, what cough? The others are like, that's all they could hear. So that's the thing. Are we going to focus on their few eccentricities or on their good qualities? So don't concentrate on the faults. Faults don't matter.
Isn't it also an additional layer of teaching there? That for me, how I see it is gurus are always revealing to us the nature of our mind.
Yeah.
And the first time I watched the video of Lama Zopa, you know, with like he kind of, you know, coughing and
coughing and spluttering for the first 20 minutes or something.
Right. And coughing. Mm. And so I was like, you know, it's the nature of the mind, you know, it's kind of like I felt, you know, I don't know what I felt, but say annoyed. It wasn't annoyed, but something along those lines. And then it's like, it's like something about this for me. And so you learn essentially about your own projections and what you'd expect a guru to be like. And then you face the, you know, kind of a reality. And to me, now it's kind of refreshing.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Because you have to analyze your or confront your own projections. Is this how a guru behaves? And
is
then it's
an enlightened being.
Yeah, is this an enlightened being? And what I expect an enlightened being to be is to have like the screenplay of a movie.
Yeah.
A beginning and a narrative arc and an end. And frankly, you know, if it doesn't have that, then what? What's going on? That someone's going to cough and splutter for 20 minutes?
Or talk about aliens
or anything like that. But, of course, it's like late people have to come. People have to deal with their own impatience and annoyance.
Yeah.
And so let's just bring it up straight away and get it dealt with so that it's out of the way.
It's right here.
And you just see, like, all of your hatred and all of these terrible thoughts just go whoosh, and then you think, I'm not like that. No, but hello, I am, because it just happened.
I am.
Yeah, so it's a great leveler. So incredibly skillful. And which is also like we, from our side, it's like really, it's like tuning a radio. We have to tune in.
Yeah.
And once you put that effort into tuning in, literally onto that kind of wavelength, then you're just there for the duration. And that duration, it's like, it's not just over the scale of like a couple of hours, because Rinpoche teaches from such a huge perspective that it's over millennia. It's not even over decades or lifetimes. It's millennia. It's so huge. And here we are, this tiny little speck, able to just listen in for a moment. How extraordinary. So, the shape of it is much, much bigger. I actually thought the way Rinpoche teaches is like some really out there jazz composition, because I did plot the trajectory of it once, and it's like theme one, theme two, theme three, theme four, about 6 hours later. Theme three, two, one, good night. It was amazing. So all the different strands of the stories and everything, where you're going with this, would all come together as, the tone, all these different voices. In fact, when he was reading the Sutra of Golden Light with the 23 chapters or however many chapters, each chapter is in a different voice like that. Yep.
Mason Jane says, isn't it also important to have a teacher with whom you have a feeling of connection? She saw some videos of Candrila, and it's not like she even needs to speak. You just see her expression.
That's right. And Candrila is like the maestro. And so just to see a video of Candrila is like meeting the maestro, even if you get to go to a teaching in person with Candrila, it's very much like being in the presence of a maestro. Whether you'd ever be able to actually speak anything with her, I'm not sure that would be possible. So people have very extreme reactions to her, and you may find yourself having extreme reactions without, and just, you know, just like, say, at funerals, it brings out weird stuff in people. So really intense situations brings out weird stuff. And if you haven't done the prep and sat there and dealt with your mind and set your motivation and why am I here anyway and gone through all of that yourself, you'll be caught out and you'll just have an extreme reaction. And then later on go, what just happened? Yes, so it is important to have a connection, but the kind of connection isn't, we're not looking for a worldly comfort or attraction. It's got to be something much, much deeper than that, that kind of connection. And yes, so we can see the guru as kinder than all the Buddhas. Because the teachings only exist for us. The Buddha's teachings only exist because of the guru, because we've been introduced. Then there are also very practical advices for the in the 50 verses of guru devotion, which is a very, it's like a how-to manual of how to be respectful to the guru, how to say no when you have to say no, how to tell what things you say no to. It's not like a carte blanche kind of thing. And it's all there. It's not anything mysterious. It's only this tiny little skinny book. It's really helpful. So you can say no to the guru. One time Lama Zopa Rinpoche said to me about how about Lagri Tampa Sena and Karuna Hospice amalgamating. And I just said, no, I can't do that. This, you know, how it is at the time, it's going to be beyond my capability. There's no way I'm going to be able to do it. So, you know, respectfully, I have to say, no, I can't do it. And so so Rinpoche was fine with that. And Venerable Roger's like, did you say no to Rinpoche? And I said, well, yeah, it's either we do that and I'm unable to do any of the things that I'm good at, or we just keep on going this way and I can accomplish something. So it's up to you guys. So, and the whole reason that I had the confidence to be able to kind of express my limitations was because of those 50 verses of guru devotion. So it's really worth knowing them, because this is it's a living relationship that we have. We've got to be able to be authentically ourselves. There was one really amazing monk and translator, incredibly devoted to his guru, went to the monastery to finally, after giving up translating for ages, and to spend time with his guru. And his guru just got him to do all of the accounts of the whole entire monastery, all of the admin, hours and hours and hours. And he didn't do any dharma, and he couldn't say no. The most gifted translator. And so after about, I don't know, 4 or 5 years, he disrobed. He left the monastery and he disrobed. So that's, I mean, in a way, from it's such a waste, and it's just from the inability from our side to be able to say, this is my limitation. I'm dying inside. I can't do this anymore. Yeah, because in a way, you've got to safeguard the Dharma. You've got to safeguard the Dharma in your own heart as well. It could be, but you could put equal amount of patience to do the book work into study. Well, what the lesson is if you start feeling, I can't do this anymore, I have to leave. I have to leave the guru-disciple relationship. I have to leave the monastery and I have to leave the robes. But normally, you see, we only make those decisions in extremis. We don't make them with our Dharma wisdom. We make them where we wait until we feel so bad that we just kick ourselves out and then we lose everything. I mean, that's why people leave Dharma centers too, because they hold on to all the resentments. They're trying to be good. It's a worldly system of making that decision. And so then in the end, the frustration gets so bad, they just throw themselves out of the Dharma center and they never come back. So that's actually from making your decisions from a worldly point of view and not a Dharma point of view. Okay. Right. So
quarter past.
Oh my gosh. Okay. So the next, the easy things. This is just like some handy hints for, we're going to close for a month, so some of you might be doing a retreat. So the first thing to recognize is that retreat is a really funny word, because actually in the Tibetan word for doing a retreat is doing an approach. So what are we approaching? Buddhahood. What are we retreating from? Samsara. And the whole purpose of a retreat is to draw closer to the deity, and it's putting intellectual study into concerted practice in order to achieve realizations. So here I want to ask you, what do you think a realization is? What's a realization? Madonna.
Aha.
An aha?
In this context, it's probably something on the lines of
emptiness, like as in emptiness.
No, as in like the realization emptiness, like becoming an aria.
Becoming an aria. Okay, realization of emptiness, becoming an aria. So that's direct, a milestone.
Direct,
okay. Yep. A tasting or a feeling. Yep. That's what Geshe Saltram said. No? Okay, that you feel with your body, not just an intellectual thing. Okay. So how would you know if you had a realization?
Well, that's right. Because it has a sense of knowing.
Has a sense of knowing?
And that's, I think, what it is.
For how long?
Forever.
No. Piece of the jigsaw puzzle goes in. Yep. And then a whole lot more. Okay.
So that makes it like a door opening.
A point of no return, a door opening. Okay. So poetic.
The world looks different suddenly.
The world looks different suddenly. Yes. Suddenly. Perhaps you notice the world looks different, but I don't think it's a sudden thing. So actually, here is the definition of a realization.
Right.
It's an inferential cognition arising from an experiential awareness.
Oh, yeah, that makes sense.
An inferential cognition arising from an experiential awareness. So this is how you can tell if you have a realization. So it's inferred. It's an inferred knowing. So it's something that is not obvious. You've inferred it. So it's taken work. So it's a lot more than an aha moment. It's all the work that comes to it.
What I like to give an analogy to is how we think the world is round.
How we think the world is round. Yes, that's right. So how do we know? Because we've done enough study. We believe in science, as the Americans would say, and we've come to an inferential cognition. That's right. We have an awareness, and it's backed up by a whole lot of stuff. But like a three-year-old needs to be convinced. They need to get to that.
They have to care first.
So the other thing is that it's also arising from an experiential awareness. So it's a knowing or a feeling. So it's not just intellectual. And so what it is like when you, for instance, are meditating on all sentient beings want happiness and don't want suffering. So you get that, but then you need to work on it, because then when you see, the person getting up in your face showing the angry face, it takes a little bit to have an inferential cognition. They don't want suffering, they want happiness. Because they're just going, rrr. And a realization is where that is an experiential awareness, that it's instinctual understanding. But it's not there from just a baseline. It comes from educating your mind. It's a really specific thing. And if and we can tell we don't have realizations if, as we study more Dharma, we start getting crankier. You know, and there are long-term Dharma students that are really cranky, and it's like, you missed out. You missed out on actually what these realizations are. You missed out on the happiness. So this is what a retreat is for, is to do that training. It's like doing a fire drill. It's like doing the fire drill of, here comes the angry-looking person getting up in my face, and now I practice loving kindness and compassion and patience and tolerance and understanding. And I recognize the nature of their mind and my mind and the nature of samsara and all of that, until we have a natural warmth and care towards them. Then you know your retreat's been successful. So, of course, in a tantric retreat, it's you already have that. You're acting as the deity, liberating sentient beings. So it's kind of like a fire drill or a Dharma boot camp. There are different types of retreat, Lam Rim retreats. It's always good to do a Lam Rim retreat combined with deity practice. Don't just waste it as a Lam Rim retreat. Do it combined with deity practice of Manjushri or Tara or Medicine Buddha. There are commitment retreats, the deity retreat. Maybe when Jada Rinpoche comes, there might be maybe a commitment to do the mantra every day or to do a retreat before you die, for instance. If you're going to do a retreat and you're like, oh, which one should I do? Do the one you have the commitment for first. Or the one that you have an empowerment for already. There is the Nongdro retreats. So we're doing a Nongdro retreat. We're doing an open Nongdro retreat. So we're not sitting there doing it all in one go, but a little bit every day, an open retreat. And there's the 3 years, 3 months, 3 days retreat, which sounds like a long time, but the people that have done those retreats have said, I barely touched the surface and have gone into retreat again.
Wow. Rebooked the cave.
Rebooked the box. It's not even a cave. Yeah, it's really, really dedicated. And then there are, you know, Yungnae weekends. So which we should all of us aim for, at least one retreat a year. That's the minimum that we should be aiming for. And, of course, we have our Lamri Tampa Centre retreat room for members. Don't forget, nice blessed place just by donation. So far, Liam's the only one who's been using the retreat room this year, but it's there. It's really lovely. So there are some ways to set up a retreat to make it easy and conducive for yourself. So for the times, try and pick a day that's an auspicious day, or at least don't start on one of the bad days in the Tibetan astrological calendar. Usually you start in the evening. You get everything set up so that you wake up in retreat. And then you end on the final morning. And in the final morning, you do a little bit of everything that you've been doing in the whole retreat, just to touch on it, but just really lightly, just really short. And it's better to do shorter quality sessions than great big long 2.5 hour sessions where you just like hard slog. Just break it up, have an interval. Try and find a venue that is undisturbed and quiet. And if it's not quiet, get some really good earplugs. Got good earplug technology now. But really the tricky thing is you need a do not disturb sign on your door so that people don't come in. to just like, oh, where's the shopping list or whatever. You really people have thought, oh, maybe you can go and get a nice hotel room or a place by the beach or somewhere with a view. That can be nice, but actually it's better to do a retreat in a holy place like Chenrezig Institute or here, or you know, Copan in Nepal, or any of the holy places, anywhere where it's like it's consecrated, where there's holy objects, because that will help your mind. It'll inspire your mind so much more so than just a quiet place. And then set the boundary, the retreat boundaries. So where you can walk and where you won't, so that you're not tempted to just like duck down to the shops when you're starting to get bored. Who you can talk to, who you won't, how your family can contact you if necessary. It's good to write it all down so you know these are the limitations. This is my discipline. Then you get set up your seat and the altar. So the seat, make sure it's comfortable. Have a couple of variations, you know, cushion and a chair. There are ways that you can set up your seat also with the kusha grass and all various things. And they often put like the svastika, it's a square one. And so I'm not sure if this is how it was done, but my mother Inta said you do it by getting little grains of rice in the shape, and you put it on the seat, and then you put the cloth on the top, and then you cushion. And she said, and you're not allowed to wriggle, because at the end all the rice has to still be in the proper shape. Oh. Very skillful of her to tell me that. And then you have whatever of the ritual implements that you need. And then you set up a nice altar with holy objects, with the various offering bowls, the tormas. So Geshe Toshi Sering said for the tormas, maybe in Queensland, we don't necessarily make those beautiful ritual cakes because the ants and everything will come to them immediately. So just put them in a nice glass jar so they look nice and no insects can get in to eat them. So very, very pragmatic. And so our retreat room, it's all set up like that, and then we can help you. And then the practice. So you combine Lamrim with the deity practice. Make sure you follow the instructions so that you get the results that you're expecting. And first create the merit. So create merit before you even start. Make offerings to the monks and nuns. Read lots of sutras, do prostrations, sponsor Dharma books, sponsor statues. So this is, as Venerable Rabina says, it's like putting fuel in the tank. So we can't start the retreat with an empty tank. It won't turn out well. You've got to start with a lot of energy, really good energy. They often say do incense puja on the top of the mountains. You know, offer to the poor, save lives, whatever you can to make merit. And then the other one, spend the money, especially on the fire puja at the end, which can cost almost as much as the whole retreat sometimes. So don't get stingy about spending money on offerings. It's better just eat baked beans on toast for the retreat and really go to town with the offerings. So the water bowls here, the seven water bowl practices offering water and the qualities of water.
Yes.
And the tantric ones are like in the initiation where it's the two waters, and the flowers, incense, light, perfume, food, music.
I thought that was okay.
They're the tantric offering bowls. And there, that's right, Ian, thanks. They're inside the cabinets behind the glass.
Oh, wow.
So this is all just really kind of just a checklist for when you need it. And then you determine, I won't move till I'm finished. And how you'll know that is you ask yourself, what would cause me to leave the retreat? So that's the more challenging the retreat, it's the more important it is to ask yourself that. Especially like Nyungnaes, when they're doing Nyungnaes up at Chinrezig Institute, quite a challenging retreat. You've got to think, what would cause me to leave the retreat? You know, would it be my father in hospital or my father dying? I mean, I've had to ask myself this question about pilgrimage. What would cause me to leave the pilgrimage? What if my father dies while I'm on pilgrimage? As a daughter, how do I negotiate this? So I'm thinking, well, what's the most use I could be for my father if he dies? Pilgrimage, that's right. But if you've got to ask yourself this question beforehand and know, because in the heat of the moment when it happens, you're going to be all at sixes and sevens and won't be able to contact your inner wisdom to make the right decision. And so I've seen people up and leave a retreat, up and leave Lama Zopa Rinpoche's retreat because their grown-up daughter broke their ankle. And then they got there and their daughter's like, get out of the house, Mom, you're annoying me. Yeah. It's like they'd already left the retreat. So it's a good one to ask. How long a retreat should be? So they always say, especially for tantric retreats, it's in four sessions. So they're four sections of the day from the sunrise to noon. Noon until dusk, from the dark to before sunrise, then sunrise to noon, then noon to dusk, and then from dusk afterwards. And if you can't do all four sessions, then do the first session each day, so before dawn. If you're doing an open retreat, you do the before dawn one. That's the most important, because when you become a Buddha, as within and as without, as enlightenment dawns, the sun is rising. It all happens simultaneously. Break the sessions into the shorter ones to keep fresh, especially, say, the after-lunch session. And so then how long the retreat should be. So there's two ways to count. One is numerical and one is sign. So a numerical retreat is where you have, say, a mantra recitation and usually for highest yoga tantra, you do 100,000 recitations. For lower tantras, you usually do 100,000 per syllable of the mantra. So Om Mani Padme Hum, Om Mani Padme Hum, 600,000.
Medicine Buddha was
10,000. So that...
Of the long
mantra, yeah. So then that's at the discretion of the Vajra master, but for an approach retreat, this is kind of like the rule of thumb. And then you add on the 10%.
Why is it called wisdom rate?
Because the mantra changes. You add in extra syllables for that last 10% if it's a tantric retreat. So there's, say, the Tara mantra plus the extra syllables becomes the Tara wisdom rate.
The pristine showering
mantra. So that's one way to do it. You count and then you have collected this tangible amount of practice that you can offer. The other is you can do a retreat, a sign retreat, that you will not move from retreat until you receive a sign from the deity or a vision in a dream. And so for this retreat, it's very important that you do the pre-dawn session for this.
I'm trying to remember, is it Lama Tisha that was for like 3 years in retreat and then went back three more?
Looking for a
sign.
For a sign, that's right. So the sign might take a very long time and the sign may have been there the whole time.
That's the dog.
That's right. With waiting for Maitreya to appear.
But
yeah.
The sign was there the whole time.
I don't know if it was a t-shirt. I can't remember because I'm terrible at it. I always garbled it. A sangha. I always garbled the details of this. But you know, it could also be a very quick retreat. And then for the mantra recitation, so if we have if we have a if we are counting the recitations, we have to recite the mantras properly. And so normally you recite the mantras from coarse to subtle. So the coarse is the reverberation of the sound. So you can hear all the syllables. For instance, Om Mani Padme Hum. And if you're counting 600,000 of these, you've got to have 600,000 Om Mani Padme Hum, Om Mani Padme Hum, while meditating on compassion. Then the more subtle way of doing this is that you're no longer reciting, but you're reading the syllables. So, and I put this picture of like a sparkler going around, because if you do a sparkler point by point, it's just dots. But as it goes faster, it becomes like one continuous thing, because the most subtle recitation is simultaneous recitation, where all the sounds happen simultaneously. So there are different ways where Om Mani Padme Hum is one simultaneous whole sound. These are different ways of recitation. But a mantra commitment is verbal recitation, which means Om Mani Padme Hum. Because in a way, if you're counting mantras and there is a tendency to go Om Mani Padme Hum, Mani Padme Hum, Mani Padme Hum, Mani Padme Hum. So you can't count mms. And what that is you're kind of flowing naturally into this other type of recitation. But for this purpose of, say, a numerical retreat, you've got to actually say the mantra. It's a verbal recitation. And then there's a way to say the mantra, which is this, not too fast and not too slow, so you don't get tongue-tied. Not too loud and not too soft. And this is very important if you're doing your retreat in a group, because you have to say the mantra, right? And if your neighbor is saying the mantra at a different pace from the way you're saying it, it'll drive you insane. And so what Geshe Tashi said about this is how loud to say the mantra is so that your collar can hear but your shoulder can't. Not talking whilst reciting and no wandering mind. So that means you can't be reading whilst, you can't even be reading the Lam Rim whilst reciting Om Mani Padme Hum. Just doing the recitation. And not adding words or losing words. So that you have a degree of alertness that you don't end up missing a syllable. So that's just a general rule of thumb when you come and do the retreat. And then handy hints in retreat, or how to stay happy on holidays. It's really important we stay relaxed. And Corey Jackson in the CEB will tell you this as well. It's really important. So the main things to focus on in the meditation is the meditations on emptiness and the mantra recitation. All the other things, the offerings and the mandalas and the prayers and whatever, they can come and go. You go with the flow. But you really must spend concerted effort on the emptiness and the mantras. Because remember, they're the substantial causes, Dharmakaya and Sambhogakaya. So we have to have them in there. So put great effort into that. And then in the breaks, relax. Read lots of commentaries on the practice, paint the satsas, do something, you know, that's just not intellectually going to strain you. Do whatever other daily commitments you have. Do prostrations if you're feeling a bit sluggish. But something really enjoyable, creative, colouring in the deities. Because the breaks are part of the practice as well. With your food, bless the food, of course. If it's lower tantra, avoid the black foods, and there'll be instructions about that, like yungne, there's all sorts of things that they're not allowed to eat. Have a bigger lunch and the smaller meals on either side. And if you like, take precepts, but you don't have to. And, of course, when you bless the food from a tantric point of view, which is you offer as a deity to all the deities. And, you know, your wisdom realizing emptiness offers to all the deities and experiences great bliss. And the last point keep your body healthy and clean and keep your mind relaxed and abandon all conceptions of what is good or bad. So this kind of means what happens on retreat stays on retreat, and you may be incredibly joyful one day and you may be crying bucket loads the next day because you're going through stuff and all of it is part of the process. So don't get super excited if you have a good dream, and don't feel really terrible if you have nightmares. It's all part of it. It's all good. And in fact, see, all sights as the deity, all sounds as the mantra, and all thoughts and memories with divine pride. So they're probably the most important things to remember going to anything, teachings, on retreat, pilgrimage, any big event. So any questions on that before I do the little summary? Only gone over a little bit. Any other any retreat or holiday questions? As usual, we've covered a lot today. We've looked at the guru devotion, the key to success. And if we haven't found a guru, doesn't mean that we won't ever. We can make aspirational prayers, and they will come. It might take a few years, but you will meet your guru. And to balance study, integrate our study, we really do need to do a retreat, and then otherwise we'll burn out and lose the joy. And so this question, are you becoming happier or more miserable? That's a good indication you need to do a retreat. If you have a commitment, could you live with the regret of putting it off? So again, we don't use our ordinary worldly view to make this decision. We use our Dharma wisdom to make the decision. Volunteering in a Dharma center is where we get to put all of our altruistic intentions into practice. Like, I want all sentient beings to be happy, just not the ones in the kitchen, because they're really annoying me. We really quickly kind of figure out how well our practice is going. So really, the question now, out of the whole course, out of the whole 8 weeks that we've been looking at, am I ready for Tantra? Have you got your answer? Have you got your answer? One thing is, you don't need to know how it works for it to work. Just like you don't need to know how an engine works to be able to drive the car and have, and you know, use it. The rarity of Tantra, so they say the appearance of a Buddha is more rare than a star in the daytime. And I kind of like that analogy because, you know, when Jesus was born, there was a star in the daytime for 3 months beforehand, wasn't there? So people knew someone really important, really special was coming to this world. They also say that of the 1,000 Buddhas of this fortunate eon, only one will teach Tantra.
Wait, what? I didn't
know
that.
Yeah, 1,000 Buddhas of this eon.
Yeah,
this,
yeah.
Only one will teach Tantra. And actually the 1,000th Buddha said he will teach whatever everybody else taught. So maybe that's two. Shakyamuni Buddha is the only one that taught that will teach Tantra.
Okay.
And number 1,000.
Yeah, at the end of the
Kalpa.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's right. So there's that we're here in this little window of opportunity. And then if you just think in this world, okay, in all the six realms, we're here in the human realm. And out of all the 7 billion human beings, only, I know we, the Maronan gold call, off you go. You know, out of all the human beings on the planet, maybe only out of 7 billion, maybe half of those are interested in a spiritual practice. And out of those, who finds a path that suits them? And even if you find a path that suits you, who's got the time or the resources to follow it? And, you know, like if you're a woman, pretty much all the way through history has been really difficult to follow a spiritual path. In terms of secrecy, because of just, you know, no massive printing or anything like that, we couldn't get our hands on any. And here we are in this really extraordinary window of opportunity. So if you want to know, am I ready, you've got to like look at the big picture here. And so you've got to balance this decision between I'll never feel ready and I'll never get another opportunity. So in a way, if we think of it, it's like, say, if we won lotto, if you won $10 million and you went, oh, I don't know if I'm ready for that yet. Would you ever say that? Even though we know your whole life would be turned upside down immediately, we'd never say no. Or we'd never go, oh, I don't know if I'm ready for this $10 million. I think I'll wait for the next $10 million. Okay, so you get the picture.
Macy Jane says, Geshe Saltram said when I asked him this, and he said, you may never get another chance, and even if you can't fully benefit in this life, you will in the
next.
That's
right. Yes, we must always think like that we may never get another chance. So even for imprints, so that we carry those imprints into the next life.
Yeah. And I had a thought, like with the I'll never feel ready and may never have another opportunity, kind of the next thing that follows on for me is a voice that says, well, get ready.
Get ready. That's right. That's exactly. So if you've won the $10 million, you just get ready. You get your lawyers and your this and your that, and you get them all lined up before you actually get the money. And then you're off and running. So, yes, we just have to get ready. So while we close, there are the Discovering Buddhism DVDs on our website. There's one Introduction to Tantra there as well. At least watch those. They're really inspiring. So they're in the resources page. Everybody can watch them. And let's dedicate that we make the right decision, as we know we will. You're dear, you're dear, Lama Sangye, Troy, you're near, Troy. Chan choi sem choi rinpoche ma kya pa na kya kya chi kya wa nyam pa me pa ya pa ne kong tu pa wa shu chi te kong te pa te ma lu pa ka le chong we sa pa Kadri so me tenzing ya so la so wa dev so to she long dru shu so so chan jin jen gong ya we tenzing ya fel we kon so do po se Cho son ko we le mon to dro pa da so to che gon to shop te shore.